Right, well, we're in the British Pavilion now, here in the Giardini, talking to Tony Craig. Tony, the first thing is that the reception of your works here and their installation seems to be very positive. I mean, you've worked on this project for quite a long time now. In fact, we talked about it very briefly at Documenta. Are you now too close to this to be able to say what you think? Are you pleased with the way it looks?
No, the installation was more or less ready in its rough form about 5 weeks ago. So I now, actually, with all the interest, which is very nice, but I actually have quite a lot of distance on it, yeah. And satisfied. It was interesting for me, the way it developed, because I came here in the autumn. I looked at this space, and which is a curious mixture of architecture. It's not a very serious kind of architecture, I must say. And I thought about what I needed to make an exhibition here, made my notes, went home, and then realized that was all rubbish. And I just actually, one result is that I actually just purely continued to make the work I was making and wanted to make and was planned and everything, without getting too involved in installation type situations, which is more or less, I think I remember talking about that in the documentary, is not to make installations, not to get involved in too many things. And the space, I'd like to say, is not very big. It's a very atypical situation for an exhibition because it's not a museum exhibition. But there's the kind of expectation involved, if not more, than there is with a museum. And the installation, I must say, it was very nerving to do it. It was more like going up on stage rather than making an exhibition, I must say. But the actual preparation of the work was very calm, and I made much too much work for the whole thing, and it was nice to have a choice at the end.
I mean, just one thing that strikes me is, I mean, most of the work here is very new, in fact, isn't it? 1988. And yet there's an amazing diversity in its sort of imagery, if you like. But, I mean, we could perhaps be specific, and we're standing next to a piece which is untitled, which, if I can just describe it, it's iron, I believe, with a large shell-like form, and beneath that, just emerging are what appear to be musical cases, again in metal. What was the source of this piece?
Well, the source of this piece is it's actually not in iron, it's in steel. And they are musical instrument cases cast up in steel. The shell is a form from a fossil that I had since I'm 12 years old or something. And the work is a reflection in a way on the way in which when a natural form like the shell grows, there are geometric growth laws involved, which has a sort of harmony in it. They're in harmony, and it has a reference for me to musical instruments. And I didn't want to put musical instruments in. I prefer to take the case because it's a bit more inferred. So the music, and also the fact. I mean, it's not just that formal thing because I mean, the first musical instruments could have been and were probably things like cow horns and shells and things like that. So there's that formal little bit of content, and that's roughly some of the thought behind it. I mean, I don't want to give you theory about or too many ideas about what the work's about. I don't want to say that because you have to stand in front of it to know what that is. But, I mean, you know, I have certain things which I consider when I'm working, that's it.
Do you have particular things that generate the form of works in the way that one did?
You mean this, like the fossil I described or something? Not always. I mean, very different sources. I mean, I don't cultivate it. I mean, although I suffer greatly without it, but I mean, I don't cultivate this kind of multiplicity of things. I mean, but I'm so chaotic in my thoughts and everything that I actually can never seem to have a system in my life for anything. So, I mean, that's the way it is. Sometimes there's a very strong model or something, and sometimes it's even just like starting off with the material without any indication where it might go to.
As well as the variety of forms, there's also an incredible variety of media that you're using. Is that something that you like to keep going all the time?
Well, I'm not sure. It's just, I mean, I'm not about the definition. I don't think it's media. I mean, the media is just sculpture as far as I'm concerned. There may be, but there is, I think, a lot of material. Well, there's some materials, yes. Are there? Wood, bronze, steel, plaster, plastic, stone. Yeah, you're right, quite a lot, yes.
Given the number of pieces there are in the show.
Well, I mean, that is also, I mean, with regard to the installation of the work, I mean, the show isn't thematic, you know, but at the same time there is sort of thematic groups of things, and I'd like to keep a sense of relationship in the whole.
Should we move just into the next room, where there's a bronze spiral of what appear to be cast children's toys, teddy bears, ducks and so on, and next to that, or on the opposite side of the room, a wooden piece. But can we talk about this? I mean, is the source of this objects that surround you at home?
No, not really. No, it's... Well, I must admit, my children treated me like a child murderer when they saw what I was going to do. No, this sort of is more to do with a genetic... I mean, it's a reference to DNA spiral helix thing, and that sort of collection of animal genetic material that's there in a very subverted, banalized, rather sad way. And the work actually turned out better than I thought, because I didn't realise that they're actually converting them into these very soft, silly things. Suddenly they revenge themselves, because they come a little bit sinister for me. I'm a little bit frightened of them sometimes. And they have, for example, the eyes in all the models have been virtually the same. They're like these plastic glass little eyes they have. And there's just something happening in the work where the eyes seem to like be dead, and they stare back up the whole work. It's quite, but they're plastic things. That's where I can't really say how clever I am. That's my decision. That was came out of the plastic process of making the work.
Yeah. It's called, the piece is titled Code Noah, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah, Code Noah.
Yeah. Well, about the titles, I mean, do they come after or before, or are they starting
always
points?
Always afterwards, yeah, without exception, yeah. No, and the titles, I mean, I don't think I'm very good at making titles, actually. It's a separate thing. I'm happy if a title gives a kind of little way into the work or something, and actually with the title Code Noah, I'm quite happy, because it really, even that reference to a sort of biblical, that way in which mankind, for whatever motivations, can be the custodian of all that kind of material, genetic material, we say, to have it back as an inference, at least, in the work.
The piece behind us is wooden construction called Loco, and the elements seem to evoke function, in a sense.
The four elements that form the base and make the surround of the work are actually from their moulds, industrial wooden patents for making steam trains. But somewhere between the wars, from a disused factory in France, and I tried to make an assemblage out of these elements because they interested me. They were originally bright colours and very hard surface. And my solution, after several really awful works, I mean, the solution was, in fact, to say, OK, well, now you have to learn how to make a wooden object. And I made this element, which is actually self-portrait, looking a little bit like Mussolini, and put it into the work in the way I have done. That was the formal solution.
Well, should we move into this next room now? This is a piece in bronze and steel, then, titled Inverted Sugar Crop. How did this piece come about, Tony?
This is a work I made, I think, almost a year and a half ago. It's partly a memory of my grandfather's farm, where in the winter they had sugar beet, and they used to feed them to the cows. So that at the end of the winter, it was a decision whether you kill the cows or whether you got enough sugar beet to, to tide them over to the spring.
Yeah.
So it's that reference, it's the memory of that. Nerus thrown up in the corner like the last odds and sods. And also of Halloween, of course. And then the idea that these things are like a sort of hybrid plant, you know, because it's like a... It's a plant, but it's also just as like a... Like we have battery chickens and other things. They become industrial objects. And it that's what... They have this kind of like bloated ugliness about them. But then they take a new dimension, of which I like.
Yeah, they work very differently to what you were saying about the toys, where you have something soft there which becomes very hard. These don't seem to take on that kind of feel, I must say, in being cast into steel.
Yeah, it's partly because they cast them so fantastically. I mean, they have these plant parts. I mean, the stems there are so fantastically filigrane. It avoids that, I think. The animals become somewhat dead, you know?
Contradictory, in a sense, yeah. Being cast in bronze.
Yeah.
Right. Should we move through to the next room, which is a... I mean, there are pieces here which seem to be... to evoke other pieces you've made, in the sense that they're vessels, or they evoke the idea of a vessel, a container. The two.
Yeah. I mean, containers are always good things. I mean, in the whole of archaeology, I mean, everybody's... I think most civilizations have been gauged or somehow measured by their pots and their glasses and things. But I don't think that's the reason for making the work. I mean, they're washing up bottles made in steel, and who would have a very, for me, very formal, figurative relationship, which is obviously a part of, very apparent at least. What I've tried to do, I've welded onto the surface of them several objects which were originally in plastic and had them made in steel, cast them up in steel and then welded them on to give the objects a kind of outer life, as if they're like climpets, as if something is starting to attach itself or you're accumulating. Could be on a very microscopic, micro level, antibodies starting to attack foreign bodies and in the body, that kind of thing. Lots of references.
And there's also in this room an older piece, a wall piece, boat, which is an outline of a boat made in driftwood. That seems to go back to some other pieces you made some time ago, which have fairly strong references to the work of Long, Richard Long. Was he important for you? I'm thinking of things like Newton's tones, and some of the other plastic pieces.
Well, I think reference to Long, I mean, Richard Long is for me a very important artist and has influenced me greatly, yes. We don't share the same sensibilities or even the same set of ideas about things. Quite often we're ending up being actually on opposite ends of a row. But I mean, at the same time, this work is, I think, was actually... is an older work. It's from 80. It's less Long influence. I mean, at that point, I really... With Newton's stones, you're absolutely right. It was a work that I even made referential, even as a little... even aggressive to his activity, in a sense. But at that point, making that kind of work was my own valid drawing method, and that's how it continued. And it was the reason it's in the show is it's completely irrational. I just wanted it here. I just, from almost from the beginning of the exhibition, decided that it had to be in the exhibition.
Right. So we'll walk now into the final room. And there's a piece with five turrets, circular turrets, cylindrical turrets that sort of reduce as they move toward the top. Again, they look like machine parts or engine parts.
Yeah, they're mainly from scrap. They're all from the scrap yards, and they're just as many round, they're disc-shaped objects. I mean, they get fat, but they're round disc objects stacked up on one another, so they go up in a tower. Have a sort of architectural reference. Also some minute, also again, like invisible, microscopic, like odontoid pegs or some strange nerve cells in the back of the eyes or something.
You've mentioned the sort of the microscopic dimension a few times, and you've mentioned DNA. I mean, is that an area that you think reveals something quite important to you, the idea of scrutinising something?
I mean, outside of this, the theme of the materials and the objects we produce and how they are relative to nature, and which is one theme. I mean, the one thing that interests me greatly is this massive world of invisible, unperceivable information that's around us. Yes, we know about things like genes and chemistry and stars and pulsars, and electricity, but nobody sees the damn stuff. So we're having that which one can perceive is being left behind by a huge ball of invisible and non-perceptual information. And I think it is a problem. There has to be some way of dealing with that, you know, not to make it harmless or something, but there are millions of images there that and concerns.
Well, chemistry obviously has formed quite a rich vein for you over the years. I mean, speaking as we were about vessels and the use of obvious everyday things like washing up bottles, also flasks from experiments seem to figure quite a lot. There's a three-necked flask there, mother's milk, again cast in steel, and these sandblasted things here from which one uses in chemistry experiments. But this one that seems quite interesting, this collection of glass objects, and the way that, as it were, they're kind of made from sand, but also they're being reduced by the same material.
Yeah, there's that. That for me, one of the formal things about it was just this glass, this breakable kind of shattering material, and just to see it have these holes and become like that, it starts to look very morbid, very soft, as if there's something. I mean, everybody assumes it's done with acid or something. It's not. It's just with the sandblasting working on it. And the containers themselves, for me, are important just because these things are like a little bit like a synonym for stomach, you know, or maybe some almost Hieronymus Bosch type containers.
Still at the British Pavilion, talking to Nicholas Longstall. Nicholas, we've just interviewed Tony Craig. We've just walked around the pavilion, and I think it's true to say that most people that I've spoken to here seem to be very impressed both with the work and the installation of the work. And I know that you're obviously involved, but what do you think about it now that it's here and it's realised in the pavilion?
I think that the recent museum shows, in fact museum shows that Tony has done for some years now, each show is an additional insight into the development of his ideas and his work. And as the work continues to develop, you see the richness of the metaphor and the ideology of Tony's work, and the scale of his ambition as an artist. Not in a career sense, but in terms of trying to really aspire to making great art.
I mean, one thing that is immediately impressive is the amount of work, which is all dated this year, and I believe this is a selection of a wider range of work that he was considering for this installation.
I think most of it's here. There's one down by the side, which you may not have seen.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Again, broadening the kind of discussion. Again, some people have felt that a model of this sort, in terms of attempting to map or present international contemporary art is ceasing to be functional, in that some of the pavilions, the work is bizarre, to say the least. I mean, what do you think about the role of the Venice Biennale?
That's always been the Venice problem, because you're up against the inequality of the national presentations, and that's the way it's all set up. I believe that each pavilion is actually regarded as the territory of each country. One could even seek asylum in each pavilion if one wanted to. So I mean, it's very bureaucratic in that sense, in relation to the national politics and national aspirations of the art administrators and bureaucrats in all these various countries. So I think in Britain we have a good system. Most countries don't have an institution like the British Council. The British Council has done terrifically good work with this show for Tony. There are a few other countries that are able to function that way. And usually, well, let's put it another way. I think that the poor quality of many of the pavilions is fairly standard. I think this is nearly the 10th Biennale I've been to, and it compares in an average sense with all the others. So, right. You know, you've usually got four or five good or interesting exhibitions in the national pavilions of one country or another. And the artists you see aren't necessarily the best artists they have in those countries, because very often, if you bother to find out about the internal politics, you discover that the choice of a particular artist has been a compromise, because there are two or three people on the committee who could never agree. And there was one artist they could agree about, but it wasn't anybody's choice. That's the problem. You have to live with it. Venice is still a great occasion. You have the Aperto, which is a really good proving ground for the younger artists, and two artists I work with, Simon Link and Grenville Davy, I said, look, just be prepared for the worst professional experience of your life. And I saw them yesterday, and they'd been here for about a week setting things up, and they both said, you're damn right. It has, however, been much better organised this year than most, I believe. Yeah. And one sense is that everything is finished now. They're not still putting things up. The Aperto is a much higher standard than general, I think, because although they have an international committee of three curators, they chose good curators, so the curators chose good artists. And the moral to that is, get your curators right and you'll get the artists right, which is what's gone wrong in many of the national pavilions.
Right. Are there any individual artists or any displays here, I mean, apart from the one that we've just discussed, Tony's, that has impressed you, that you felt really stands out from the sort of the rest?
I have to say, at this stage, I've been so busy that I have hardly looked at the national pavilions. I've spent some time in the Aperto, because that's more of more interest to me. So I can't really answer that question very well.
We're following Nicholas Logsdell from the Listen Gallery, now Richard Cork. Well, Richard, we're in the Giardini section, and you've been here a couple of days, and you've looked at Tony's show. We're sitting on the veranda, in fact, of the British Pavilion. I mean, what do you think of the whole enterprise so far?
Well, not a great deal of surprises. I get the feeling that everything's hanging in space, rather, this year at the Biennale. There's not a sense that art is on the move. In fact, quite the reverse. There's a feeling of recapitulation, I think. I think it's no accident that the American Pavilion has a Jasper Johns mini retrospective, and the British Pavilion has, I think, a really excellent show by Tony Cragg, which again is by way of not a retrospective exactly, but if you look at the catalogue, I think it's symptomatic that it is at great pains to show what Tony's been up to right from art school days. So there is that feeling that somehow one is being presented with the work of the earlier 80s in general. And I think the same comment applies to the central pavilion, where you have a survey of leading Italian artists, many of which are very familiar to us, and don't, to my eye anyway, seem to have developed very much over the last few years. I was actually rather disappointed by the senior Italian artists, and to a certain extent by the relatively younger generation who made their name in the early 1980s. For example, Clemente and Sandro Chia and Palladino, who did arrive with a great splash at the beginning of the decade and now are being seen in that rather awkward period which often attends artists who have their success very early, when a question mark arises as to quite what happens next, and of course as to whether the rather extravagant promises that were made about their career earlier on, particularly by the people who promoted them with such zeal, are in fact being fulfilled. And so I think there's a slightly uneasy feeling about that central pavilion. And strange enough, the artists in that section that I felt happiest with were the non-Italians. The people like Sol LeWitt and Cy Twombly and Marcus Lupertz, who presumably were being invited because of some relationship with Italy outside their own national boundaries, which in a sense I quite welcome, actually, because I'm not altogether sure that I like this emphasis on nationalism, this feeling that an artist is turned into a representative of his or her native culture.
That was really leading on to the next question, which is, in a sense, this whole set of exhibitions have been described as, in a way, an exercise in national diplomacy. The Aperto is clearly something else, but I mean, do you see it in those terms? Because, quite honestly, some of the work here it's totally mystifying as to why it's here, and one doubts whether it is representative of the country it's actually coming from.
Oh, absolutely, and I think the whole sort of nationalistic thrust of the event is rather undermined if you look at Tony Cragg, for example. I mean, there is an artist who, of course, he's British and was educated in England, but for the last 10 years or more has lived in Wuppertal and has kept quite a distance, I think a very significant distance, from his native country. It's something that he clearly welcomes, and it's something that has made him into much more of a European artist rather than a British artist. And so when one comes into the British Pavilion and sees Tony Cragg, it doesn't mean very much to consider, I don't think, the British context, because I think he does belong to a much larger area than that, and I welcome that way of thinking, quite frankly. I don't like the idea of sealing artists up inside little boxes and saying they belong to... I mean, the Israeli Pavilion, for example, there we have Zadok Ben-David, who, again, hasn't been working in Israel very much, to my knowledge. I see him as someone who has spent most of his career, in fact, in Britain. I suppose it's useful. I suppose it's useful from the point of view of being able to get funding from various governmental bodies, which might not otherwise be available. I think money is more easy to acquire if people can make the argument that somehow it's good for the national image. But I think that has its penalties as well.
So finally, is there an artist or is there a installation, an exhibition here that really sticks out for you?
Well, apart from Tony's Pavilion, which I am impressed by, I think there are various fragments, if you like, that have caught my attention. But no more than that. I can't pretend to have come away from the Giardini with any great revelation, any great sense that my understanding of what is going on today has been significantly altered. I mean, I would say, for example, that that the Spanish Pavilion has been memorable. There is a feeling there. By juxtaposing an example of a senior sculptor who died some years ago, giving him a bit of a memorial show in a way, with the work of someone who I think is quite promising, who is still a young artist, I suppose, that I found that quite stimulating, because I found that I was thinking about a continuity in Spanish art that I hadn't perhaps expected to find. Although these two artists are very different, I think probably there is a context in Spanish art from the Franco era that we perhaps don't know about enough, and we're too easily ready to dismiss what went on during Franco's time, whereas I think probably the truth is that these quite respectable artists were working away quietly. And that Spanish art, far from having simply benefited from the post-Franco resurgence, does in fact also benefit from the fact that serious artists were working away during those years, albeit unsung both inside and outside their national boundaries.
Well, finally, Richard, what about the Aperto section? I mean, do you think that that's a successful representation of what's going on now internationally?
I find the Aperto section quite baffling and very difficult to talk about because it's so fragmented. And I was longing for some feeling that an overall selector's hand had been at work. And I do wonder whether it is, in fact, advisable to have so many people selecting an exhibition like that. I gather they only met twice during the course of their work, and each meeting lasted a couple of hours. And I don't get the feeling that any coordination had taken place. And you came away with this sense that a haphazard event had been unfolded before your eyes, which I think is a great shame, because I think the Aperto section is potentially the most interesting part of the whole Biennale. And it certainly offers young and lesser-known artists a marvellous opportunity to make their mark in an international context. And I think it's a pity when that opportunity seems to be thrown away, because I don't think that the Aperto, as it's organised this year, helps our understanding of what is going on in art. I think it actually promotes the idea that everything is very haphazard, and that nothing unites artists working today, whereas I'm sure that's not true, and I'm sure it would be possible to mount a much more coherent exhibition which proved the opposite case.
Il premio internazionale la Biennale di Venezia 1988, consistente in un leone d'oro a Jasper Jones a maggioranza. È destinato alla migliore partecipazione nazionale all'Italia. L'opera di un artista giovane promettente a Barbara Bloom a maggioranza. La giuria ha infine rivolto una speciale menzione a Tony Craig e a Enzo Cucchi, le cui opere sono già internazionalmente riconosciute.
Well, I'm now talking to Henry Mericuz, and we've just, in fact, heard the announcement of the jury, and I believe Tony Craig's name was mentioned. Can you tell me precisely what prize, or in what context, his name was mentioned?
Well, there are three prizes for the Venice Biennale, and the first one is the Leone d'Oro, the Golden Lion, which last time was shared by Frank Auerbach and Polka, the German artist. The second prize is for the Best Pavilion, and then there's a prize for artists under 40. There was, I believe, considerable debate within the committee in the award of the prizes, No vote was finally taken, but a majority of individual opinions suggested that the prize winner should in fact be Tony Cragg, and certainly the criticisms we've had have been extremely favourable from artists as far afield as Greece, Brazil, Hungary, and there's been great excitement caused both by the work and by its presentation in the pavilion. In the end, however, the jury decided to modify the rules as they had previously been understood, and awarded instead the prize to an American artist, Barbara Bloom, who was regarded as the most promising young artist who had not yet made an established international reputation. And the jury decided then to give special mentions to two artists, Tony Cragg and to Enzo Cucchi, as artists who, although outstanding, were already internationally recognized.
So you're obviously very pleased about Tony Cragg's exhibition here.
I'm very pleased indeed with the way that the exhibition's looked, and above all the way that it's been received. I can't conceal a certain disappointment in the sense that I believe, and I know that many other people believe, that his exhibit was probably the outstanding event in this Biennale, and I'm sorry that it has only been recognised in an honourable but not substantive way.
Is there any general point that you feel you'd like to make about this Biennale? I mean, is there a particular characteristic about it that emerges for you now that we're at the end of the sort of the press period of 4 days?
Yes, I think I should put the positive point first, and that is that I think it is, in my limited experience of 4 or 5 Biennales, it is by far the best organised and the best presented Biennale. It's been presented in a thoroughly professional way. With a clear space for each artist and as near as one can get to museum conditions of display and viewing. Possibly on the less positive side, it's a safe Biennale. There's been very little risk-taking, and I think the character of this Biennale is expressed a little bit by the decisions of the jury as well, which are safe decisions, although very honourable ones.
What about the aperto section? How do you feel about that?
The aperto itself also presents perhaps little excitement, and there's no one tendency which comes to the fore, but I think the formalist minimalist tendencies are fairly evident. Certainly the aperto represents a broader range of artists from a wider geographical area than in the past.
Now, further comment on the aperto by Andrew Nairn.
I think the most interesting development actually in the aperto is the number of Japanese artists, the number of artists from Eastern Europe.
Yeah.
And that interests me a lot, because a few years ago the idea that an artist from Russia could be with a gallery in New York seems extraordinary. Now it's almost already kind of normal, and that's an area that I think is very encouraging.
I mean, one of the things one feels looking around the Giardini section anyway, should one see this as a international exercise in diplomacy or really a sort of a mapping of contemporary art?
I think it's an international exercise in diplomacy, largely, with some very good notable exceptions. And I do think Tony Cragg is a very good notable exception. But we're standing here, and the Germans have been serving wine for 3 days now. It's that kind of thing, which in a way makes it a nice place to be, but is also part of that kind of diplomacy.
Now, Maurizio Nannucci. Is there any single thread, if you like, that you can draw from the aperto that you think comes together as a coherent idea or statement?
I don't know. What suggests me aperto? It was a certain feeling that I have had also in the last year, and it is also strictly connected also to my works. Do you know, I have for some years worked to the concept of small difference, always endeavor to find some small difference, yes, and I think that we are looking the same way. We have this point of view, small works with very nice sensibility for the space. The artists look again not only the wall but the space, inside the space, move inside the space, try to give a different approach that could happen with the environment. I look in this direction, small text, small lines, small numbers, a small sentence, small piece of color. Personally, I'm very attracted from this dimension.
Finally, is there one statement that you'd like to make that for you sums up this event to date?
Yes, just now came in my mind this something that I has read in Wallace Stevens, and I think it will be perfect for this feeling. And the statement, or better, is some poetic text of Stevens, is it must be abstract, it must change, it must give pleasure. And I think that this three rapport could give really a dimension for new works and new feeling for the works of the end of this century, yes.
And finally, I stopped a number of visitors and asked them what they thought of Tony Cragg's work in the British Pavilion.
I think it's one of the best. I think it's very elegant and very strong. I think it's placed so beautifully that it shows off each piece very well.
I have seen his work earlier in England and other places, and these are one of the best collection in one exhibition here. And I consider this, as well as two other as most important exhibition, Venice Biennale. I thought Jesper Johns as one of finest collection of works in this exhibition. Then Arnoldo Pomodoro, his collection also one of finest in this exhibition. Some of the works are mediocre. I didn't consider them as important or even worth for Biennale of Venice.
I like the ideas. And it's different respect to the other stands. And I'm surprised at the forms and le dimensioni, come si dirà le dimensioni? And the dimension. Yeah, of the sculpture.
There's a marvellous mixture of contemporary send-up together with ancient history. So we get this wonderful crossover kind of cultural effect, which is very exciting. There's a monumentality about it. It's like he's already converting contemporary life into some kind of old monument. And one gets this kind of déjà vu feeling that you've seen it and at the same time you're in the future looking back at this particular time. But of course it's out of scale and that makes it more exciting.
What function do you think the Venice Biennale actually has nowadays? Because some people have said that really, as a model, it's really to do with the past.
Well, that's a very good question. For a while it seemed to be rather sort of old-fashioned. It didn't seem to be presenting anything new, especially in comparison, of course, to Documenta, which was the flag of the future. But Documenta has not been terribly successful this last time. It was rather uninteresting. So it made the Venice Biennale that much more important. Last Biennale was particularly exciting because there was this whole response between art and science, which was very exciting. This time there doesn't seem to be so much of an investigation. There don't seem to be the in-depth analyses and investigations and experiments that there were last time. So I'm finding it a little bit duller this year. But hopefully, and of course, I have to draw the exception of certain exhibits, such as Tony Cragg's, such as Jasper Johns, such as the Spanish exhibition, the Spanish sculpture, which I feel should have won a prize.
Yeah.
And I'll still come again.